In Genesis 15, Abraham is moaning to God. He's lamenting the lack of a male heir. Culturally, this lack was huge. Without a male heir, his name and his memory would not live on, and his possessions, including his wife and slave, would become the property of another. Previously, his God had promised Abraham progeny numerous as the stars in the sky and the sands in the sea. Yet now, chapters later, Abram still sees no evidence of this. The entire ancestral narrative from chapters 12 to 25 in Genesis is dominated by this question of an heir. Anxiety and doubt are frequently part of Abraham's conversation with God. Doubt and faith are not mutually exclusive, but woven together. So too are failure and faith. Maybe that's why this reading is set for the middle of Lent. To briefly summarize the succession saga in the chapters of Genesis, Abraham's wife Sarah is past childbearing age. She therefore suggests, as was common in the Near East, that Abraham have intercourse with her maid, the Egyptian slave girl Hagar. Hagar conceives and bears a son, Ishmael. Abraham is delighted. Sarah, however, is envious. Hagar, she moans to Abraham, is treating me with contempt. And Abraham tries to dodge the conflict. She's your slave. A number of years go by, and then, according to the story, God decides to favor Sarah, and she too conceives and bears a son. His name was Isaac. Sarah, however, was not content. She petitioned Abraham to cast out Hagar and his teenage son Ishmael into the desert, where they would surely perish. Abraham, though in grief at the situation, consults his God, who seems to agree with Sarah. The child of promise would be Isaac, not Ishmael. So Hagar and Ishmael are cast out, though later they are divinely rescued. God seems to flip-flop, wanting to put a dollar each way, and saves them. Well, there are four interpretive keys or lenses that we need to read this story through to understand it. The first is ancient biology. The second is patriarchal power. The third is what is called texts of terror. And the fourth is the fragments of God we find in Genesis. In ancient times, sperm was considered to be seed, namely what we would call a fertilized egg. The woman's womb was merely a garden or an incubator for the seed. All the chromosomes were thought to come from the male. So any child a man fathered, regardless of the status of the mother, was 100% genuine offspring. Abraham's firstborn son and heir, therefore, was Ishmael, not Isaac. To follow the directions of his God and his wife Sarah, and to cast Ishmael out, was to visit upon his rightful heir a huge injustice. No theological gloss by later editors can disguise this fact. Further, this injustice around inheritance would be perpetuated into generations to come, causing huge distress and enmity. The second thing to understand is patriarchal power. Abraham and Sarah did not have one of those 21st century relationships of mutuality and equality. The patriarch ruled the clan. All slaves, all wives would belong to him. He had the power and the responsibility. So when Sarah moaned to him about Hagar's behavior, Abraham had the authority to mediate a just solution, which he failed to do. Hagar is punished, and Sarah's envy goes unbridled. Similarly, after Isaac is born, when Sarah outrageously requests him to not only elevate her son to be heir, but to cast out Ishmael into the desert, Abraham needs to use his patriarchal authority to mediate what is best and uphold what is right. Again, Abraham fails. He seems to emotionally freeze up and become incapable of exercising leadership. In a patriarchal world, it's not fair to blame Sarah for what happened to Ishmael and Hagar. It was not Sarah's decision. Her power, compared with the patriarch, was minimal. It was Abraham who failed. In casting out Ishmael, he grievously wounded his heart, and his heart never recovered. The phrase "texts of terror" was coined by Professor Phyllis Tribble to describe the stories in the Bible that were thoroughly bad news for women. Not only were the women in these stories, and she uses four examples, victims of cruelty, but the text portrays God as either silent, absent, or assenting to the cruelty. In a similar way, Philip Culbertson has written about texts of terror for men, including this example of Abraham, who in response to the petitions of Sarah and the apparent will of God, abandons his firstborn son to a likely death. Abraham has argued with God before, arguing for compassion rather than punishment. Yet here, when his son's life is at stake, he loses his steely backbone and succumbs to the pressures upon him. Not everything in the Bible is written for the purpose of imitating or emulating. Not everything is in the mode, "Abraham did that and so should we," or "God said that and we should obey it." Some parts of the Bible are written as history, some poetry, some parables, visions, etc. And some parts of the Bible were written for us to recognize injustice, its origins, the connivance of the powerful, and the culpability of the God involved. These stories invite our participation in making sure they never happen again. To mistake a text of terror for a go and do likewise story is not only to misread the Bible, it's to repeat again the injustices of old. So what is God in the book of Genesis? Well, it can be friendly and benevolent, but also terrifying and cruel. The attributes of divinity seem unable to be held with integrity within one concept of God. Simply, God can't be loving and cruel, for the love would undermine the cruelty, and the cruelty would undermine the love. Hence, some authors talk about gods, plural, in Genesis, including those named Yahweh, Elohim, El Shaddai. Karen Armstrong talks about Genesis offering us glimpses of the divine, which can only be fragmentary, imperfect, and colored by the culture's experience of life's inherent tragedy. I think God is, and yet more than, a cultural construct. Each culture tries to name and describe its individual and collective experiences of God. And early Hebrew culture was no different. Although primogeniture, that lovely big word, which means that the firstborn male inherits the power of the patriarch. Although primogeniture was the norm, time and again it didn't happen. And so stories evolved to explain why it didn't, and why God didn't intervene to prevent what was unjust and destructive in patriarchal society. Stories evolved to explain why the eventual heir, the winner if you like, became the winner. In God's mouth was put the rationale of the winner. Yet also in these stories are hints that winning isn't everything. Isaac, though heir, would be a big loser, for he never gained his father's unconditional love and never learnt how to show and teach love to his children. In the next generation, as you may recall, Jacob tricked his firstborn brother Esau out of the inheritance. But Jacob goes on to live a conflicted life in a conflicted family, and in turn he bequeaths it on. What's so likable about Abraham is that time and again he questions the reasoning and integrity of God. This is how the Bible understands faith, not parroting creedal formulas, but courageously risking to question and to probe and to engage with the expanse of God. Abraham pushes at the boundaries of his culture's experiences of God and frequently crosses them. Philip Culbertson points out a contemporary relevance of the Abraham and Ishmael story. There are many men and women today who, due mostly to divorce, have two families with two sets of children. Their current spouse or former spouse tries to influence the relationship with your children, like Sarah did. You feel pressured, caught between the demands of these spouses and your feelings for your children. To give one set of children all your attention, for example, is to cause grievance to the other set. As for wills, legacies, etc., there is potential for much bitterness. The man or woman in this predicament is conflicted by a desire to express their love for all their children, to express their love for their current spouse, to do what is right and just, and to feel loved and rewarded in turn. There's significant potential for getting it wrong. What I like about the Abraham saga is that the authors do not shy away from revealing not only their hero's faith, but also his failures. Abraham, in abdicating his patriarchal power to Sarah, in listening to his God instead of his heart, in doing what was expedient rather than what was right, grievously wronged his firstborn, Ishmael, and seeded an enmity between the ancestors of Ishmael and Isaac that continue today. And I refer to Arabs and Jews. Abraham screwed up. He failed as a family man. He failed as a patriarch. He didn't question the motives of the God he was listening to. His faith froze and he became a servant of circumstance. Yet there is also something wonderful about the biblical editors leaving all this in for us to learn from. There's a message here that the faithful do fail, often with irrevocable consequences. The faithful do screw up, and usually the screw-ups can't be put right. Spiritual growth is all about stepping out, risking uncertainty, putting a foot wrong in order to put a foot forward. As Joy Cowley says, people who don't make mistakes don't make anything. If Abraham had stayed safely at home in Ur with the gods he knew, none of this would have probably happened. But he didn't. He took a risk, a series of risks, compelled by his understanding of God, fragmentary though that was. He risked being wounded, and he was wounded in the heart. A life of faith and a wounded heart are often companions together on the spiritual journey.